Welcome to the House Transportation Committee today. Let the record show that the Transportation Committee convened at 8:01.
Joint meeting, please.
Oh, yes. Today we're privileged of meeting jointly with the Senate Transportation Committee. And Senator Kukesh, I'll let you introduce your members and then I'll introduce mine.
Sure. Thank you very much and appreciate you all being here today. With us today we have Senator Pascban from Fairbanks and Senator Menard from the Valley and myself. Two other members of a committee who aren't here yet is Senator Meyer and Senator Davis, and Senator Davis is just walking in the room now. So thank you very much, and we do have a quorum of the Senate.
Okay. And representatives on the House side are Representative Dugan, Representative Munoz, Representative Johansson, Representative Gruenberg, and myself, Wilson. I'd also like to recognize the staff that we have with us today. Carrie Cooper Ryder is our Senate Recording Secretary, and the House Recording Secretary, who is present today, is Nancy Hemingway. And
we're transporting chairs. Okay, go ahead.
And Jack Wade is our LIO monitor. So my committee aide is Becky Rooney, and I think maybe she's disappeared all at once. But and the Senate committee aide is Nancy Barnes. So before we start, I would like to have to list announce to shut your cell phones off, because even if you just turn them on to vibrate, that still interferes with some of the technical devices up here in our microphones and whatnot. So if you would actually turn them all the way off, we would appreciate it. And today we've asked the Department of Transportation to give us an overview on their organization as a whole. And they will be drilling down in some key areas with information that we might need as we go along and discuss bills and deliberate on the different issues at hand. So the first three meetings are going to be overviews. And when I say overviews, even we want to be able to track the money so we know where the money goes and where it sets and what, you know, all that type of thing. So when our constituents ask us those questions, that we'll know. So our first agenda item is an overview by the Commissioner of the Department of Education or Transportation and Public Facilities, Leo von Schieben. And Commissioner, would you please introduce yourself? And I think you have some other people you've got back there for backup. I'll let you introduce them.
You got people.
I got people. Okay, I'll introduce myself first. I'm Leo von Schieben. I'm pleased to represent the men and women and the governor for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. With me, I have Jim Beadle with Marine. I got Frank Richards with Highways, Nancy Slagle, the Money Lady.
Can they raise their hand, please, so we can identify?
Nancy, raise your hand. Jeff Otteson with Program Management, Ron Kane at Program Management, and Mary Soroki as Special Assistant to me. So with that, I'll just jump right into my little program here.
And you all have, I think everyone has the handout. So you can just follow along, so we won't have to turn around. We've got it in front of us. So,
okay, well, our mission statement for DOT is provide safe movement of people and goods and the delivery of the state services. A little bit on the structure. It's more of a matrix structure. Several people report to me, but I wanted to give you some key people that I work with very closely. In Northern Region, Steve Titus. Southeast, Gary Davis, who's new to us now, and most of you know Gary, used to work in the legislature for 8 years. He is also a good background with the for Kenai on roads and the city of Kenai. And he's got a degree in Bachelor of Administration from Alaska Methodist. He just joined us two weeks ago, I believe. Gordon Keith in Central Region, Most of you know Gordon. He's been here before. Frank Richards is a deputy commissioner and public for highways and public facilities. Christine Klein has been on board now for aviation for a year, and she's doing quite well. And Jim Beadle, 30 years, I believe, with the Marine Highways, but Jim has taken over after Dennis left, and he's doing a great job. So I'm not going to go and name all the rest of them, but those are some of the key people that I get involved with. The DOT is kind of, it covers the whole state, of course, but the northern region, you can see the line kind of goes from east to south, from west to southeast. Northern region covers the vast majority of the state. Central region has a huge area it covers going southwest out of the central area and then southeast. Just to give you some ideas of the numbers of staff, headquarters people, we have 346 people there. In northern region, I have 719 people. Central region, 967 people. And southeast is 227 people, with AMHS, 836 people. That totals 3,100 employees for the DOT. So it's a large department. So look a little bit about the highways. And if you look at the map, you can see it's more of a north-south look to highways. And that's the National Highway System, and that's the one that we get the federal funds on. We have 2,113 centerline miles of highways throughout the state, but the majority of it runs north and south, going through Fairbanks, Anchorage, and then a little bit to this leaving the state. So you can't see the dotted line very well, but Marine Highways is involved there. They cover 3,500 miles, so between AMHS and an NHS system, we cover 5,600 miles of traveling media through the state. And now we have the Alaska Highway System, which is the state-owned system, or state highways and rural roads. They cover 1,508 centerline miles. So the combination of the two of them is, you know, several thousand miles there. DOT is also has maintenance stations throughout the state, 84 of them. 30 of them, 30 plus, are off the highway system or in our rural communities, and they are at the airports. We have 250 some airports, which I will talk a little bit more about in my presentation. But you can see a lot of maintenance stations on the highway system, a lot of maintenance stations in southeast, and then west and southwest, there's a few. DOT also runs manages ports and harbors. We have 25 state-owned harbors, and 12 are operated by agreement with the local government, which I'll mention a little bit more later. We're responsible for 25 of the 99 public harbor facilities in Alaska. 12 facilities are operated by local governments that we've turned over to them, and we have operating agreements with them, but they don't provide operating revenue in those agreements. The capital part of those ports are largely the Corps of Engineers program, except bond funds and state match. And the Corps funds breaks, they break down to breakwaters, navigational channels, state and local fund mooring basins, and inner harbor facilities. So between the Corps and the state, we are very active with our ports and harbors. Measurements and standards. That's another piece of the DOT. That piece of my organization enforces all federal and state commercial vehicle laws to ensure state highways, safe highways. It certifies the accuracy of all weighing and measuring devices. It issues permits. It has a web-based permit system. It works closely with the trucking industry and legislature this year to increase the penalties for overweight vehicles first time in 30 years, so we work very close with the trucking community. DOT has airports. Boy, do we have airports. 258 airports, largest in the USA, with a capital budget of $200 million a year, AIP, Aviation Improvement Program. Capital budget of $200 million. You can see they're they're all over the state. Every community essentially has an airport in some shape, way, or form. I wanted to just kind of fill you in that we're currently working on a systems, Alaska Aviation Systems Plan, which is going to come out in the next few months. And that plan is going to cover, identify airport improvements needed, set priorities for funding, propose aviation policies, and document the existing system with photos, maps, and data. So we are putting together a systems plan, a systems analysis for aviation, and it's going to come out very soon.
Leo, I neglected to ask you if you wanted us to ask questions as we go along, or would you rather we wait till the
end? I was going to do it right at the end. If that's okay with you all, I make my presentation and we can talk later.
Okay.
DOTPF Airports, the largest airport owner, like I said, in the USA. We have two international and 21 certified and 235 communities. I wanted to make a little comment just for interest while I have this slide up. Regarding the international airports, we're seeing a 12 to 15% downturn in the past few months because of the fuel that started happening in July. And we're seeing less travel, less passenger, and less freight. So it's looking to be 12 to 15% down. We have 134 rural airports, a maintenance contract out of a total of 3 million. We average about 27,000 per airport in our rural maintenance. Our maintenance program, FY08, has 21.1 million in operating funds for facilities. Highways and airports, 122.6 million. For FY09 maintenance program, highways preventive maintenance is 11 million. Pavement rehab is 39 million, and aviation preventive maintenance is 4 million. This slide here, I want to just share a little bit with you. That line on the top, it looks fairly linear. That's the maintenance and operations general fund authorizations. It's been going up at about a 2.75% per year. So it's been fairly linear. Back in 83, I come up with about 85 million. Now we're up to somewhere in the $150 million range, which gives you a 2.75% linear income, not income, but growth. The line below is kind of up and down, but it comes in about 1.5% per year. You'll notice the last 3 years there's been quite a jump, and I believe that has to do a lot with the cost of doing business in the maintenance area. So before 2005 it was fairly flat, but then it started to go up 6, 7, and 8. Construction. We do construction. We build things. We have a construction group. There are regional construction offices, each region, northern, south central, and southeast. Each has a construction branch. The construction consists of contract administration, field inspection, oversight, and quality assurance. Our construction budget, and this is an interesting and probably will have some interest there. Highways and ferries, we have $738.6 million for FY09. That breaks down to $698 million for highways and $40 million for aviation. AMHS, I'm sorry. $40 million for marine and $698 million for highways. Aviation has $350 million about, facilities has $26.3 million, and harbors has $16.5 million. Historical construction expenditures for all AMHS, highways, and aviation, you could draw a line that smooths that out, and it comes out to be about a 17% growth. So if you just drew a line through the center going from left to right upwards, it's about 17%. We have safety programs, traffic corridors, which I am very familiar with. I drive through one out of Big Lake, every day back and forth through one, Big Lake to Wasilla. The 511 program, I called that program today to check on roads. It works. It's traveling to know road conditions. You can find out any road in the state of Alaska by speaking to the phone, and it speaks back. Pretty clever. Road and weather information, we have photos and weather data there. Intelligent transportation system for vehicle commercial vehicles. I want to make an interesting point on that one later on in my presentation. Just take a second, but I got something I think you'll feel is very intriguing. And then we do size and weight enforcement and safe routes to schools. Traffic safety corridors, like I mentioned, the one I drive through on the Parks Highway. There's a Seward Highway. And we're working, establishing three more, one in Kinnick Goose Bay, and one on the Sterling Highway, and one on Palmer-Wasilla Highway. In those corridors, you probably all know it's a double fines and there's more patrols, but it works. It seems to slow traffic down and people, as long as it gets patrolled, it seems to work. If the patrols aren't there, people start to slip a little bit. But that it does work and it does save lives. Some of our accomplishments over the year, 17% reduction in square footage for structurally deficient bridges. We've been working on our bridges this year. We had a survey done here, bullet number two, Ivan Moore survey, 2% increase in the percentage of survey responders satisfied with our maintenance programs from 2005 to 2008. We had a 3% increase in voluntary use of seatbelts and a 22% reduction in fatal and major injury crashes 2005-2006. I don't have 2007 data, and I asked why I didn't. They're just now coming out with it, but I will have that data fairly soon. But anyway, we've had a 22% reduction in fatal and major injury crashes. Also, our M&O crews have laid linear feet, 1.5 million linear feet of highways with surface crack seal treatment or re-leveling depressed roadway surfaces by banding. Now, you're all really sitting on the edge of your chairs asking yourselves, what is banding? Right? Banding is transverse crack by cutting cracks by cutting 6 to 12 inches of asphalt and filling with gravel and asphalt. It really is a way for expansion and contraction of pavement and kind of solves that area. So it's called a banding process. We've paved 33 lane miles of gravel roads. We've paved 213 lane miles of roads. We reconstructed 31 lane miles of roads and performed 529 bridge inspections per the federal regulations and their standards. No small accomplishment on the bridges, that's for sure. On our efficiencies, we're using some innovative techniques to extend life of pavement, which is rubberized crack seals, sealing, banding, like I've mentioned before, hard aggregate to make our asphalt wear longer. And we've elevated the importance of public facilities. When I first came on board, public facilities was all over the map in the regions, and I put it all under Joel St. Aubin. So now we have an efficient operation in the public facilities. Ports and harbor grants programs, I'd like to share a little story there with you too later here. Key department challenges. I do have some major challenges regarding recruitment and retention. When I first came on board 2 years ago, a statistic was given to me that a third of the workforce, now remember I have 3,000 employees, a third of that workforce is eligible to retire in the next 0 to 5 years. So if you were to take a third of 3,000, it's 1,000 people. It's not to say they all will do it, but 5 years from now or 3 years from now, the department is going to look different because that workforce is going to change. Preserving and protecting Alaska's infrastructure, big deal. It's all about money right now. We've got a lot to preserve. In fact, Gordon Keith told me that in Central that he has $300 million worth of mill and pave that he could do on the rutting situation in the Central area. Major proposed transportation projects We got the gas line coming up, which we're putting estimates of in the millions and millions of dollars out there for Dalton, Elliott, the rich. We got to work on those. High inflation, economic downturn. I'm preaching to the choir here. You all know about that. We got two bills coming up in aviation and in highways for reauthorization, and an aging fleet. We got aging equipment. I've got aging Marines. I got four vessels in Marine that are 45 years or older, and that's getting up there. I'm at the end of my formal presentation. What I'd like to do is maybe make some points that anticipate some of your questions, and I will just throw these out. Juneau Access, Gravina, and Cabada, I was going to give you an update on the three big projects. Juneau Access, we're working closely with Federal Lands, a federal organization, Western Federal Lands out of the Pacific Northwest, their highway division, to get a third-party estimate or an independent estimate for that project. We should have that information by March 6th. We are currently under litigation regarding the NEPA process, and it's in federal district court judge, federal district court. Judge Jack Sedgwick is the judge that's working on it. He is supposed to be giving us some interpretation or response here any day now. Gravina, when I was down in Ketchikan last September, I basically said it, I don't have the money. I'm not going to do any work on Gravina until we have a little better plan. The governor said that the F1, which was a very expensive bridge, was too expensive. She told me to go back and come up with other options. To do that, I had to go to another supplemental or a supplemental EIS. We are in that supplemental EIS as we speak. The draft EIS will be done this mid-year, this 2009. The final EIS will be done at end of the year, and a record of decision will come out sometime in mid-2010. Cabada, I have a conflict of interest there in Cabada because of my past life, because of my old company is proposing on this project. But I can tell you this, Cabada is also under a third-party estimate, and it should be done sometime this month or early next month. Estimates for that project were 4 years ago was $580 million. So that's the status of Cabada. What I'd like to do now, with your indulgence here, I'd like to tell you a couple of success stories that I personally had happened to me this year. Yakutat, if you don't mind, I'm going to pass you a couple of photos. Maybe you can pass them around. The reason I brought Yakutat out is one of my success stories. I personally got a call from David Stone out of Yakutat. And if you've learned anything about me, I came to this department with the idea that I want to build things. And I got a call from the Yakutat saying there was a glitch in their harbor program application. We have this program where we have X amount of dollars. We had $555,000 ready for Yakutat, and it wasn't going to go through because they didn't fill their paperwork out right. And one of my staff members says, well, we have to deny them. And I says, do we have to deny them? And he says, no, they're not following the procedures. So we bounced it back and forth in July. They finally came to an agreement that they were going to work with me. We worked with the staff. We worked with David Stone. That project is now being built. If I hadn't stepped in, and I'm not saying because I'm some special guy, I just had a real interest in getting it built. If we didn't step in, that would have gone another year, and that project wouldn't have been done. A success story to me is getting that done. I've had a couple of them happen. Gustavus Dock, $21 million dock. $10 million was going to be from us. $4 million from the parks, $4.2 million from the parks people, the National Park Service, they go ahead. And then they came up with another $3.5 million. and because they were supposed to come up with half, and they were shy a couple million, and it wasn't going to go through, and we were going to lose $7.5 million worth of money, and that project wouldn't have went through. I worked with the staff, we worked with Gus Davis people, and we're able to put that project out through scope work and in some money thought process there. The terminal connector between Anchorage and at the Anchorage Airport, there's a north terminal and a south terminal. That project was $45 million, and it was programmed to go this spring. And we were all set to go. The contractor was out in early spring driving piles, and then the fuel crisis came. And the airlines came to me and says, we can't do this job. I can't afford it. Can you do something? Well, I have a contractor digging in the dirt and putting a project out there, and the airlines want us to stop it. I was able to bring that project under control, reduce the scope of work in half. It came up to somewhere around $30 million, and that project is going forward. I guess my point I'm trying to make is I feel very strongly about getting projects built. That's what I'm here for, and that's what I came for. I have one other one that I think is a real success story because it's a great, great photos. It's Tuntutliak. And if you want me to spell it for you, I will. T-U-N-T-U-T-U-L-I-A-K, Tuntutliak, Tuntutliak. Anyway, I was out in the Bethel area this fall. Got to visit some of the sites out there for aviation, and I came across this project here. It's a 5 or $6 million project. The boardwalk was another couple of million. Anyway, it's a project that for bush communities, you see a boardwalk instead of a road. And if we were to put a road in there, it would have dammed up drainage and would have caused all kinds of problems. So Tuntutliak has a brand new boardwalk, a brand new airport, and the total price was around $6 million and plus a couple million, I believe, for the boardwalk. So with that, I'm open to questions, and I have my staff here to, if it gets over my head, but I'm open to questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
I have several questions, but I don't want to dominate, so I'd be more than happy to chunk them up so other members can ask questions. First of all, on your three big projects that you mentioned, Kinnick, the Juneau Access, and Gravina.
Right.
Two of those three, you're using an independent third-party analysis of the cost. You
right.
mentioned Kinnick and
right.
Is that a common practice that the department uses, a third-party analysis?
Through the chair, I don't know if I'd say it's common, but those projects are they're so visible and so like Kibata. I mean, you're talking, 200,000, 300,000 people in the South Central that would be involved with the use of that bridge. I just think it gives maybe more of a confidence level on these two projects. We were confident in our estimates on Juneau Access. We felt very good about that. Regarding Kibata, I think the estimate was held too long and not updated, so we weren't as confident as that. But I don't think it's common practice, no.
Follow up.
Go ahead and follow up.
Probably the most high-profile project is the Gravina Access. Was there a reason why there's no third-party analysis of that?
Well, in that area, we were putting another supplemental EIS out, so they're going to redo cost estimate there. So there was no, we didn't sense the same situation as the other two.
Go ahead, follow up.
So it's not a matter of confidence in the department's numbers. I mean, why have a third party on those two and not on Gravina? You're confident with Gravina numbers, but not on the other two? Is that
well,
happening?
Through the chair, yes, I'm confident that the numbers are, since we're putting another supplemental EIS out, they would be recrunching those numbers again and making them more current.
And yet they're the same people that are crunching, their department employees that are crunching numbers?
The supplemental EIS is being done by HDR, I believe it is. Yeah.
Okay. And just one more question, and then I see Senator Paskman has a question. And then regarding those three projects, mm-hmm. is the department going to hold back on reprogramming that money until you get these estimates and until the SCIS is done on Gravina, or will they be reprogrammed to another project throughout the state prior to you getting final numbers?
Through the chair, it's my intention not to move any money around until these things are all done.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. Okay.
Senator Paxman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shaben, Von Shaben.
Yes.
Anyway, I met you up at Girdwood, so nice seeing you again.
Thank you, sir.
Von Shaben. In the 2009 construction season, what dollar amount of projects do you believe are going to be taken off the shelf? And then in addition to that, with the potential stimulus monies, what projects might be ready to be part of a stimulus package?
Stimulus. There isn't, through the chair, there isn't a day goes by, there isn't a half day that goes by that I don't hear something about stimulus. Let me tell you what I know and can share with you right now, if that would be okay. This stimulus thing started back this summer. We're talking stimulus, but it really started to heat up here this fall. If the president signs a stimulus package mid-February, if it's 120 day or 150 day or 180 day, which I don't know, it originally was a 90 day stimulus. We were really under the gun if we were in a 90 day. Well, it turns out it's now 120 day. Well, it turns out it started going from 120 to 150. What I do know is our STIP process, which we have to do regarding stimulus. We have to put projects into STIP, and that takes 90 days. So we have started the STIP process. That started last week. So there's 90 days to get that going. What I know so far on the stimulus is that it's 50% has to be done before whatever amount of days they pick, 120, 150, 180, 50% of what they give you, you have to start constructing. Then I hear the word obligated. It's one thing, is maybe it's awarded, maybe it's turning dirt, and now I hear obligated. I'm hearing 180 days in obligated. So we are preparing for the governor projects, and we have bid-ready projects, and we have a good chunk of bid-ready projects, anything from aviation to highways. But right now, we're still bouncing it back and forth, and to tell you the truth, there's not much I can share with you because I really don't know yet what we're going to end up with the amount of money we're going to get. At first it was $250 million. Now I hear it's less. And I hear aviation. That was for highways. Now I'm hearing it's less for highways, and I'm hearing less for aviation. I don't know right now what to tell you when I don't know what we're getting. And mid-February we'll know a lot more because hopefully the president signs it. So that's about all I can answer for you right now. We do have projects. They are bid ready, and we can respond, and we start our STIP process. So I think we're on schedule. Mr. Jeff, I think we're on schedule to meet whatever they throw at us, but I don't know what they're going to throw at us yet.
Senator Davis.
Thank you very much. Just a follow-up to that, you say you have a list of them that are ready to go. Do you have them prioritized as to how you would like to see them funded?
Through the chair.
And would you be able to make that decision?
We don't have them, through the chair. Not right now. I don't have them prioritized. But we have work that's ready to go under bid-ready, turn-dirt projects. We have a whole list of them. And I think we have enough to cover, so far, whatever's coming out. Our main concern is to make sure that we had them. So we do have a list we're working on, yes.
Senator Kukesh.
The governor had asked you to look at other options on the Gravina project. Do you have those other options that you could list for us?
I have the draft supplemental sitting on my desk, and since there is no limits on Gravina, or sideburns, as my staff likes to call it, we're looking at, I think, looks like about a dozen different options, anything from ferries to other bridges to no construction.
Could I follow up, Senator?
I'm sorry, I didn't say through the chair.
How many meetings have you had with local people on those options? Or have they helped you develop those options at all?
We're following the supplemental EIS process, so I am assuming there is public hearings in that process, but I can find out the exact numbers for you, but I think we are.
Can you bring that information at the next meeting so that we have that information? Because I think there's members on the committee that are really interested in that. And so if you could just kind of update us on what the other options are and what timelines are and things like that.
Can I ask a question?
Representative. He's nodding yes.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
I think. Back to Senator Pascvan, and Representative Dugan may remember from last year's hearings in transportation, I think your staff identified some $250 million in projects that were on the shelf and ready to go. So apparently you have $250 million worth of projects that are waiting. That was testimony when you were trying to get the $1 billion highway trust fund put together. Just
to the chair,
for the information.
Those numbers are good. Those are fairly good numbers you're talking there.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for the presentation. Could you tell me what the department's next step will be once a decision is made on the NEPA lawsuit regarding Juneau Access? Or what? How do you see this process unfolding?
Good question. The problem I see with Juneau Access is further lawsuits. I mean, this thing could drag on for a couple more years in lawsuits. Again, I think you know I like building things. I just don't know if we'll ever be cut free for a while regarding the legal system. And I think that's going to take some time. If we get a positive back on the NEPA from Judge Sedgwick, we could get it sued again for something else until they run out, you know. So I think we could be in court for a couple more years.
Representative Kukesh, or Senator Kukesh, I'm sorry.
Commissioner, you mentioned and didn't elaborate on it, but could you elaborate on agent fleet and what your plans are for the agent fleet?
I have a systems analysis that's on my desk. And I'm very pleased with the document. I'm just fine-tuning it, and it will be done within the next. Jim, we said within a month, right?
Hopefully less.
So well, that system's now to be done. Then there's a phase two that'll come out a year after that. The aging fleet, we have, I believe we have a shuttle ferry under design.
And you know what? I'm going to. Our next meeting goes into a lot of the ferry system, so if you don't mind, I kind of like to hold our questions for the ferries for the next meeting, because then that whole meeting is going to be taken up with almost all of that type of thing, if you don't mind.
Should I pull seniority here?
I could still touch on a piece of it?
Go ahead.
What I know, the four vessels are aging is the Malaspina, the Matanuska, the Taku, and there's I can't remember the other one. There's four of them, and they're all 45 to 46 years old. It takes 6 years to get a vessel from the time we order it till the time we get it. Mm. We had we're working on a shuttle ferry design. As we speak, the price of one, we're guessing, and I think we are guessing right now, because it's $80 to $85 million. Seattle just had a boat come out that they were going to put under contract, was $60 million. They were 50% off on their estimate, so we don't really know the number yet of what the value is. And I think once with the design is done on the shuttle ferry, which is we're going through public hearings and all the rest of that. So we'll know more when that's done and when I get the systems analysis done. And
just to follow up, then, if I could.
Follow up,
I just want to make sure that at the next meeting when we have the overview that you have that available for us. I really appreciate seeing that. And I only followed up, made the comment because you'd mentioned Agent Fleet and didn't make any other comments about it other than that. So appreciate that.
We have four boats that are aging, underaged.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, in her address to the legislature last week, the governor singled out the road to Nome as a project that she was interested in seeing go forward. Is the department involved in that? And if so, can you give us some idea of where that process
sure.
might be? Thank you.
To the chair. If you look at that slide I gave you showing our highway system, we got a north-to-south spine right through the state. And I'm glad we got that. I mean, we can go from southeast and with the ferry system up to Anchorage and straight north. We have nothing west. So there has been several studies put together on the road to Nome, and we retained a consultant, Dahl Engineers, to compile all those studies, to look into rights of ways, to look at corridors. And various options, various corridors to get a access going west off of the roads that we have going north and south. Really, when you look at it, we have nothing west out of Alaska. We should have something west. So we're doing phase one, compiling the information. It'll be done September 09, and that will be the first phase of getting that available. And it's coming out of the northern region, Representative. It's Steve Titus. And if you want a debriefing paper, I can get you one. Mary can, if you, would you like that?
Sure. You bet.
Mary?
Is she there? Oh, yeah.
And Mary, we'll get you a debriefing paper. You give that to our office, we'll make sure everyone gets a copy of that.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Pascagon.
Yes. With, again, focusing back on the stimulus package monies that likely we'll know more about in about one month from now, but is there any thought given to those monies going directly to the municipalities for their determination of priority of projects as compared to going through the Department of Transportation? And if they were to go through the Department of Transportation, what general thoughts do you have on overhead that DOT, PF might
add on top of that?
Yes, or 100%. Take out of the top of.
Well, let me get to the first one, and Jeff can help me if I need help. But my understanding, they're talking to the MPOs, which is the municipalities, that will get their own chunk of money. And it'd be independent of ours, right? So they're going to get some money. We'll get some money, and it'll be by formula funds. As per what we put on top of it is... for example, if it was a project that we're going to mill and pave something, you know, maybe we're doing out of Anchorage or something where we mill and pave project, we usually add 10% to 15% for our engineering. Sometimes you can go high as 20% when there's soils and investigation. That's the kinds of things you're thinking about? Because we have to put the plans and specs together. Is that what you're thinking?
As compared to having monies possibly go directly to the municipalities.
Well, yeah, if they get their own money, we don't add anything onto that. We just do the projects that come to us, and then we have to do the design and put the plans and specs together. But we don't add anything on top of the municipality's money. Does that make sense?
No. I believe I'm following you.
Okay.
Representative Johansson.
Commissioner, do you plan on being present at the Marine Highway hearing coming up, or is this my last chance to talk to the guy in charge?
When is it?
It's Thursday, I believe.
This Thursday.
This coming Thursday.
I'm here Thursday.
Are you here Thursday?
Maybe not.
It's a short question, so maybe I'll just fire
it. I really don't know, but I get back to you. I don't know my
Madam
schedule.
Madam Chair, if you mind, just go quickly back to the Marine Highway.
Yes.
Very specific question. I've talked to the Southeast people. I've talked to the Marine Highway people. I've talked to the third floor. And everybody tells me the layup facility in Ward's Cove for the Marine Highway has been described as extremely close to closing for about the last year and a half.
Extremely close to closing for a year
closing and a half? The deal. Uh-huh. I mean, the money was appropriated 4, 5, 6 years ago, and DOT has had it who knows where for that long. And I'm wondering where that's at in your mind. Is it on your radar? How close are you to spending that money the legislature appropriated? I think it was 2 representatives ago from my seat.
Are you talking the Ketchikan layup facility in Ward Cove, you're saying?
That would be the Marine Highway layup facility in Ward Cove, correct?
It is on my radar screen, and we put a consultant agreement together this December to do the work. We're looking at the contaminants and dock buildings and the site, and so it's under a study situation, but I don't know much more than that, and I can get back to you on additional information for you.
Madam Chair, I would hope so, because I've said before, I've talked to, when Mel Menzies was here, I've talked to Mr. Beadle, I've talked to the borough, I've talked to the third floor people, and they all tell me that you guys are just close to closing a deal on getting this thing, an agreement with the borough, mm-hmm. So they are the landowner. And you're the only one I haven't talked to, and it seems like many of them point to the commissioner's office as just waiting for the final yes. Mm-hmm. So I hope you would engage yourself in that. It's been appropriated for about 5 years, and we're getting tired of not getting a decision, either yes or no. You're asking for money for a Prince Rupert dock, and I'd be hard to support another appropriation if it takes you 5 years to finish a project like that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you had indicated earlier when you were doing your presentation that you might have some more to tell us about the recruitment and retention challenges within the department. So I wanted to give you a chance to tell us that if you wanted to.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan. When I came on board 2 years ago, I read that statistic, and I thought, oh, boy, we're going to have problems. What we're doing there is I think we're going to have to end up at DOT with a different way of doing business that isn't, that you can't count on hiring any more people when they're not out there to speak of. The labor force in engineering and surveyors and CAD people, those people just aren't out there. Now, with this economy we have going on, it's possible that we could get more from the outside that could come up here. But I'm going to lose a third, any from marine engineers to surveyors to CAD people to accountants to whatever. So I'm going to have to look at a model that maybe has less of those technical people and ends up in the area of more contracting and more subbing work out. And the reason I say that is I have recently had a team of individuals go down to Pacific Northwest talk about program management. In other words, we may have to manage the programs outsourced. For example, the gas pipeline. You know, I estimated it would take 500 people to produce that $2 billion worth of gas line work that we need, infrastructure that we need. We don't have those kinds of people, so we're going to have to outsource a lot of work. So I had a group of people go down and visit Idaho, Oregon, and Washington to talk to them about program management. And I think a lot more work is going to be outsourced, and we're going to, not because I don't want to hire some people, I just don't think we're going to be able to find the staff. We got to have more of our kids go to school in engineering and architecture and surveying and in business and stop going to school to be attorneys and the like. You know what I'm saying?
Representative.
Is anybody up there an attorney?
Yeah. Representative Johansson.
Yeah, just quickly, is this hiring freeze imposed by the governor going to put you in a pickle, and are you going to request any waivers?
Well, we'll be doing some waivers, but I don't think it's going to put us in a pickle because like with the stimulus stuff that's coming out, we may have to outsource work to consultants and stuff. I think we can get our help from some of our consulting help and not have it hire permanent staff. I'm not sure how a hiring freeze works within the state, but I don't think we're going to have a problem meeting the deadlines, especially if they move it 180-day out type stimulus with a deadline, then we'll have a little more room. So I don't sense any problems right now. It will in the long run, you know, because of the people we're losing. And we want to fill some of those positions.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So is outsourcing, I guess, okay with hiring freeze? If you're,
well,
I understood it was to save money. So if we're outsourcing,
in the area, there's certain work that I have to get done, which is the stimulus stuff. And if I have to get some design projects finished up to make sure that they go out to bid, I'm going to ask to get that kind of waiver. I would be missing the boat if I couldn't get my work done.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. A question on the Prince Rupert facility and the request to put money into that dock. Are you aware of Canadian Pacific's plan to expand the ore terminal and possible conflicts with dock construction? It's a question that we brought to the director of the Marine Highways System, and I haven't gotten any feedback yet on that, and I'm wondering if you're aware of that situation.
So the chair, I just know about the Prince Rupert dock failing us a while back, and we weren't able to use it for a while. So, and they upgraded it and brought it up to snuff, and we were able to use it. That is all I know about Prince Rupert dock. And if there's something my staff can get to you, we'll look into it.
That would be great. Thank you.
Mary?
Yeah, if we can have that by the next meeting, that would be great. Let's go on. The first half of the meeting has been on your presentation overall. And did you have a question?
Actually, if it would indulge the committee, I had three more quick questions for the commissioner while he's here, because I know he's getting out of town pretty quick. If you don't mind, I'll go very quickly.
Go ahead.
Very quickly, with harbors, 25 of 99, you said, are still owned by the state. Seems like the state was trying to get out of the harbor business. Are you still trying to get rid of those 25, or have we?
Well, I think we'd like to turn more over to the cities and have the ones that use them or the communities that use them. But there isn't there's nothing coming across my desk for a big push.
Okay. And second question. The two international airports that the state owns and operates, do you have a contingency for getting a third international airport, possibly the Ketchikan International Airport, if that were given back to the state and its associated access issues?
Well, to the chair, what was the question? I didn't think.
If Ketchikan gives their airport back to the state, we operate it at this moment. Ketchikan operates their airport. It's owned by the state. We can get out of that and give it back to you, basically. And I think your staff is aware that is a possibility. I'm just wondering if you would kick that around while you're discussing Gravina access issues, because along with getting the airport back, you would be responsible for providing access to that airport, I would assume. Mm-hmm. So,
I have nothing has come across to the chair. Nothing has come across my desk regarding transfer of that airport.
Something to think about. The folks down in my neck of the woods are seriously discussing that. And finally, one that's very important, I think, for Representative Munoz and myself. During the operating year this year, we had just basic maintenance issues with the condition of our roads down in Ketchikan. And we contacted Southeast Region, and they told us that they didn't have enough money, and we'd have to wait till the 1st of July, and it took about 2.5 months. So, have you looked at that problem and requested, I guess maybe you need more money in your maintenance operation, or is it the same request, or in April are we just going to have to wait a few months to get potholes filled?
Through the chair, I'm going to have to get back with you on that one. I don't know.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else that has any questions? Okay, I have a question, and you might not know it off the top of your head, but I'm sure some of your staff might. But that road weather information system, what's the number?
511.
511?
Yeah.
Okay.
I called it before we came here to make sure it works. I can just see you saying, what's 511?
So, and then you just tell them what road you were interested in?
They give you a menu of things, and then you just, by voice.
So it's not a person, it's not a real person?
It's a computer type generated, and it just says, say the road name, like Parks Highway or whatever, and it will spit off information for you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, you have to have roads in your community to be able to take care of it.
Oh!
It has to have a name.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the situation on the bridges? We heard about some of the bridges being unsafe earlier, I guess last year. And I'm just wondering, are you going to be coming to the legislature for anything on that? How are we doing? Are you getting new direction at the federal level? What's happening with the bridge?
There are three bridges, through the chair, there are three bridges on the Seward Highway they're on these timbers that are just huge timbers that are starting to deteriorate, and we're going to have to fix them. I mean, we've got it down to one-lane traffic and the traffic signals, I think all three of them will be done at the end of the summer and fixed. Regarding problems with the bridges, they're getting older, but there's none that are unsafe. It's just that there has to be a program to start fixing them up, and we have a bridge program funding, federal funds. So we're getting to it, you know.
Representative Johansson.
Yeah, we asked that question last year in transportation, and it was testified that you do have a program, and it was sufficient to meet the challenges on repairing the bridges. That was testified to last year, and I'm not sure if anything's changed in the last year, but we felt comfortable with that.
Well, our program is not changed through the chair. It hasn't changed. I mean, we still have a program. We have people inspect the bridges. I can't think of it. It's once a year, once every other year, Frank.
Every 2 years.
And so every bridge that we have gets inspected, and I think we have some that we're contracted to inspect too, right? If you want, ask the bridge guy. I can bring him up here. He's the
before you answer, make sure you give them your name so that the secretary will be able to type
it up. Madam Chairman, for the record, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Through the Chair, Representative Johansson, last year we did identify, after the collapse of the I-35 bridge in Minnesota, we did a check on our bridges of those similar bridges in that design with the gusset plate to make sure that our bridges, if there were any in the state, were in safe conditions. And our bridge engineers went out into the field, did their inspections, and came back and said that we did have safe bridges. Now, what the commissioner showed you in an earlier slide is that over the years we have been using the federal highway funds for bridge to do rehabilitation and repair on our bridges, and we've knocked off a considerable amount of the square footage of our bridges and brought them back up into the safe category, meaning not in the structurally deficient category that Federal Highways uses in their categorization of our bridges. We were successful in the GO bond vote last year and received $20 million of funds for emergency bridges that we can use around the state. The commissioner just identified three specific bridges on the Seward Highway that have deteriorated and now are load limited, and we're using those funds, and we're very, very fortunate to have those funds to use to do the immediate repair of that. Otherwise, we would be here asking for possibly $10 million for needs for those three specific bridges in our system. So it's a critical part of our mission, and we are taking it very seriously. We are doing the biannual inspections, and as the bridges come up and the needs are defined, we're seeking the funds to be able to accomplish that work.
How many bridges are under the auspice of the state to make sure they're maintained and taken care of?
I don't know.
Madam Chairman, we'll have to get you that specific number back. I'd rather. There are bridges, though, that are off system, in the communities of Ketchikan, in the communities of Juneau, and in the communities of the other boroughs, that I think that you will see the mayors coming in and asking for some help and support for those bridges, as they have seen those bridges deteriorate. They're off the system, the federal system, so the state is not putting money into those bridges because they are community-owned.
When you bring us that information, would you let us know how many are state and how many are municipalities, so that we would have an idea?
Madam Chairman, yes. And actually, the legislature was very helpful last year in providing us with funds to be able to do inspection on some of those off-system bridges when our inspectors are going to those communities. Previously, we didn't have the funds, meaning the federal funds or the state funds, to pay for those individuals' time and expense to be there to do those off-system bridges. So we've done some of those inspections this last fall, and we'll have an idea and be able to report back to you.
Good. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Any other ones? All right. Thank you very much, both of you. And our next item on our agenda is the statewide STIP, which is the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. And Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development for DOT, is going to do the presentation. Jeff, please introduce yourself and your affiliation, and now, do you want us to ask questions as we go along, Jeff, or would you rather have us wait to the end?
That would be fine, Chair Wilson.
To ask as we go along?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I think that's a little easier to do for us, I think.
So, Chair Wilson, Chair Kukesh, who I think left the room, and members of both committees, welcome. I'm Jeff Otteson with Alaska Department of Transportation. I'm the Director of Program Development, which is responsible for programming federal funds used for highways, bridges, and ferries, among other things. I'm here today to talk to you about the STIP, and I want to apologize specifically to the two representatives that have been through this before last year, so that this may be a bit repetitive for them, but I was asked here to give you a feeling for what the STIP means. I know there's some people here that have never been around this terminology, and I'm happy to try to explain that. So what is the STIP? Well, the acronym stands for Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. That is a federal term. It is found in federal law. Every state is required to have a STIP that allocates the federal highway dollars that it receives. So it's required. It has to have a four-year horizon. It has to illustrate the spending priorities for a four-year time period. More recently, they've changed the federal rules about a thing called fiscal constraint. And this sounds so simple, and it becomes so complex in day-to-day management. Fiscal constraint means we have to constantly balance the STIP and the projects and not let the money on either side get out of balance. And so we're dealing with estimates on revenue from the government, the federal government, and we're also dealing with estimates on the cost of construction. In both cases, we're dealing with estimates. We're hardly ever dealing with firm information until the last minute. And yet we're writing this STIP as much as 4 years out into the future. So as things change, we have to go back and amend the STIP and keep that fiscal constraint in balance.
Question.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm one of the new neophytes around here on this committee. So some of the questions I'm going to ask are fairly basic. Through the chair, is there a you say this is required by federal law? Is there state legislation requiring a STIP, or any state laws that modify or flesh out the federal requirements, or is it entirely federal?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, there is a state law or a couple state laws that I would say amplify and parallel the federal law.
Will you be discussing those today, too?
I was not going to, but I could certainly point them out to you in a separate communication.
That would be wonderful. I would appreciate that. So we know what our jurisdiction in the matter is, too, right. Madam Chair.
That's fine.
Thank you, sir.
So there's also some regulation that speaks specifically to the STIP and how it's processed, how we undertake it. So there's some very precise regulations as well.
If you could include
I'll include all of that.
Communication.
So The federal rules and the state rules require there'd be a substantial public process required, outreach, communicating with different parties. There are literally named types of organizations in federal law. We have to talk to transportation providers. We have to talk to metropolitan communities. We have to talk to non-metropolitan communities, to tribes, et cetera, just to give you some idea. The STIP also must conform to the long-range transportation plan required in federal law. In other words, you have to do a plan, put the project on a plan. The plan is 20 years on horizon. And then when you write the STIP has to be really a reflection of which projects on that plan you intend to proceed with funding and go forward and execute. Finally, the STIP document must be approved by two federal agencies prior to our ability to use those dollars. So we have to take the STIP, send it to the Federal Highway Administration, the Federal Transit Administration, and let both of those agencies review it and approve or disapprove it. So the STIP deals with what's known as the Surface Transportation Program in federal law. Historically, it has been targeted at the kind of the top level roads in each state, sometimes known as on system. You'll hear that term. It essentially is the arterials and the major collectors in each state. And that's the limit to where the dollars could be spent. It could not be spent on local roads, could not be spent on minor roads in a community. It had to go to the big roads, plus certain ferries, bridges, and more recently, transit was eligible. In 1991, federal law was amended specifically for Alaska only. It was an Alaska-specific amendment, and it basically says that any public road is eligible for the dollars in the STIP. And like all changes, it had a both good and a bad effect. But it definitely expanded our universe of eligible roads. So it roughly tripled what it became eligible for these dollars, that 1991 amendment. So other eligible work classes are public ferries and the terminals that they dock at, public transit systems, and public bike and pedestrian trails that serve a transportation purpose. So generally speaking, you can't use STIP dollars to build a recreational trail in the mountains, but you can build a bike trail or a bike path because that's perceived as serving a transportation purpose. So as I said, the other 49 states, their dollars from the STIP go to the high-level roads in those states. That's an exclusive relationship. Alaska is the only state that doesn't have this connection between the STIP dollars and being directed only to the high-level system. So in our state, these dollars are eligible to go to any public road, and they have gone to many, many what you'd call minor roads, local roads, community roads, even boardwalks throughout the state. So this is a kind of...
Representative Grunberg.
Bike paths?
Bike paths. But in villages, we often do what are known as boardwalks or sometimes called board roads. There's a picture of one here.
No, I understand, but they could be used in urban areas for bike paths.
Yes, and they are all the time, quite routinely.
Thank you.
So this just gives you an example of the scale difference between the classes of transportation facilities that we in Alaska can fund with our STIP program. But whenever you have more eligibility, you end up with, I think, too many people trying to compete for a limited pot of funds. The federal program today is simply not big enough to meet all of the original plus all the new categories in need that are out there. We in the villages, they want basic access. They want sanitation roads. They need dust control, and I could go on and on. The urban areas are dealing with congestion. They're dealing with growth. They're dealing with safety issues. And they're dealing with, in many cases, they want amenities. They want landscaping. They want trails. And then we have things like trying to upgrade the ferry system, modernize the ferry system, modernize the rural highways of the state that really don't serve a lot of traffic, but they serve the arteries of commerce. So the Parks Highway, the Glen Highway, the Rich Highway, many of those roads are still in kind of a 1940s and 1950s design standard. They haven't been brought up to a modern standard. This kind of shows you when I talk about these different classes of roads, I want to take a minute and go through this, what I call the pyramid charts. Imagine that pyramid has got four slices going through it. At the top, the arterial roads, and then the major collectors, and then the minor collectors, and at the bottom are local roads. And the area within each band is representative of the proportion of the miles of road that fall into those classes. So you can see that 18% of our roads are arterial, whereas 62% are local. The color in each band reflects the pattern of ownership. The green represents state ownership, largely DOT and a little bit of DNR in that bottom band. The yellow represents local government ownership, and the brown represents federal ownership. What you can see there is in the top three bands, DOT is really the dominant owner of those top three classes of roads. And in the bottom classification, local roads, it's really local government. And that large group of federal roads is really what you would call logging roads, largely owned by the Forest Service here in the state. So follow with me now as you go through, those bands will stay in the same order as we go through the chart. Prior to 1991, only the roads above that line were eligible for federal funds. Everything below that line was not eligible. So now we have the entire pyramid is eligible. The same four bands, but the pyramid is reversed, because what this is showing is the distribution of travel or miles of travel on the four parts of the system. And you can see that arterials are carrying 62% of the traffic. Urban major collectors are carrying almost 14%, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, it's inverse. Though the miles of road is down, they carry a lot of the traffic. The same thing is true when you measure accidents by their cost. We have a way of calculating the cost of accidents. We calculate a fatal accident with a very high number, and we calculate a property damage only accident with a much smaller number. It's a system that's prescribed in the federal books that we follow. So you see arterials likewise to traffic. They are also where the majority of accidents occur when you measure them by their consequence, their severity. So what these pyramids tell you is that the state is owning and maintaining 92% of those high functional class routes. And these routes comprise only 30% of the system, of the total miles in the state, but they're where 75% of all travel occurs and 86% of accidents occur. It really is a few roads that are the most important to the state's economy. And it's a very important thing to understand, because I think what's happened with this distribution of money being eligible to everything, you could argue that we're not spending enough money on the roads that really make a difference to the economy. So our STIP is got four funding categories, and they are the National Highway System. You saw a map in the commissioner's presentation. 2,100 miles of the state highway system is on the NHS, or National Highway System. That includes roads like Egan Drive here in Juneau. In Anchorage, it would be like Minnesota or the Glen Highway or the Seward Highway. It would all be examples of the NHS. In Fairbanks, it would be roads such as the Parks Highway coming into town, or the Richardson Highway, or the Steese Elliott Dalton leaving town. Those are the high functional class highways. The state also has a funding category for the Alaska Highway System. That's the 1,500 miles of road that are largely serving city-to-city connections. Some examples of an AHS, I'll pick Ketchikan, is parts of both North Tongass and South Tongass, particularly as you get out of the downtown area, fall into the AHS. There are many other roads like that throughout the state that are little lower in importance. We're not important enough in the eyes of the federal government to fall into the national highway system, but they're still very important to the communities they serve. We then have a third tier of funding, the Community Transportation Program. This is where communities largely compete for a slice of the STIP. And this program covers most community roads and a few state roads that fall into this category that are not on those higher two systems I just talked about. And then there's a fourth category, the TRAC program, Trails and Recreational Access.
How many miles of the community transportation roads are there?
Well, there's, Representative Wilson, there's more than 12,000 miles in the state. So if you add up the other two categories at the top, it's about 3,600.
Okay.
So it's everything below that.
Okay.
It's almost 10,000 miles, but you have to really take away things like the Forest Service roads. We're not going to probably spend STIP dollars on a logging road. So it's not fair to say that full 10,000 truly competes.
Okay.
What I will say is you look at our criteria. The criteria are trying to focus in on the minor collectors, which are a bit more important than the roads below that, the local roads, which are largely subdivision roads. There's just not enough money to do all those classes. So whenever you have scarcity, you do have to prioritize. So this chart shows you how the money gets distributed. First, the big circle shows you those four categories: National Highway System, Alaska Highway System, track, and CTP. There's the number right there. It shows that there's 10,500 miles served by the CTP. Those two slices outlined in orange are eligible for community nominations, and then that becomes kind of a new circle off to the right of your chart. And by federal law, Anchorage and Fairbanks get a portion of that money allocated to them directly, so they make their own decisions about those projects. And so the rest of the communities in the state, what are sometimes called the non-metropolitan communities, compete for that other 65% approximately. So Juneau's, Kodiak's, Angoon's, you could just go on and on around the state, are competing for their projects out of that 65% slice. I can just make one point, and then this percentage of about 40% of the money going to local government is about double the national average. So we are clearly among all 50 states sharing more of our STIP dollars with local government than any other state DOT.
Now, how do you, every community thinks their road is more important than anybody else's, I'm sure, you know. So how do you go about making that decision of which ones to fund?
We score projects with a scoring system. We treat that scoring system as our gospel, as our Bible. The problem we're facing now is a few years ago, this program was able to deliver 10 or 12 projects a year. The amount of money in it, the size of each project. And so people could sort of see that we'd get to their project because we were making progress every year. And what's happening now is the price of individual projects is consuming almost all the funding. We have a project this year that will go out for $40 million. And we only have $65 million to share statewide. So the first project pretty much takes over half the program.
Wow.
Last year we had a project that, if we had funded it all in 1 year, would have been closer to $100 million. So we're fighting this problem of inflation, and as you'll see in a minute, we're also fighting a problem that the actual dollars going into these pies, because I'm only giving you here percentages, I'm not giving you actual dollars, the actual dollars going into the program are going down. So bigger costs, smaller pot of money to draw from. We're down to one or two projects a year.
Representative Johansson.
Looking at your pie chart here, looks like the NHS and AHS, 56% of the pie, and the marine highway or ferries eligible for both of those categories. Is that correct?
Marine highways draws largely from the NHS. A few of its terminals draw from the AHS, so it's eligible for those things.
Follow up. So terminals in AHS only?
Well, historically, the vessels have been NHS eligible, and the terminals have been either NHS eligible or AHS eligible, depending upon whether they tied into an NHS highway. So, for example, the terminal in Skagway touches an NHS highway, thusly, the terminal at Skagway is NHS eligible. The terminal at Angoon does not tie into an NHS highway, thus its funding had to come from AHS.
Just one more question.
Follow up, Representative Johansson.
And on your scoring system, following the chair's question about how you rank projects, how much wiggle room does someone in your position have in the scoring system? How much leeway does DOT have to maybe arbitrarily score certain portions of a project higher or lower, or is it all pretty strict?
It's pretty strict, quite frankly. In fact, you will find that the region advocating for a project are pretty zealous advocates of their project. They make very good presentations. There's a lot of detail in the presentations. There's a lot of give and take in the scoring. We talk about the scores. I really think the problem is not with the scoring system. The problem is how much money we're able to put on the street each year. That's really the core problem we're facing.
Just quickly.
Go ahead.
And when you say it's strict, is it strict from the bottom up, from the region coming up, or are you hamstrung by federal strictness? That's what I'm trying to get at. If you're being, if it's your own people who work for you who are the ones that are kind of guiding you in your direction, that's one thing. But if it's coming from up above, that's another thing. So is the strictness from the feds or internally with DOT?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but as best I can, we follow our published criteria as careful as we can. We try to be very true to them. So the scores come out as they do. The scores are what they are. There are six high-ranking members of the department scoring, three from the regions, the three regional directors, and three from headquarters. And I think if you attended one of these, we can spend 45 minutes an hour on a single project. It's a lot of, there's a lot of deliberation that goes into that process. So we're reading the criteria, we're reading the material about the project, and we're assigning scores against those criteria.
I have a question, and that question follows up something that the commissioner said, because I would think that there would be communities that knew they had their, does this count the money they have on hand that they have to match and all that? So when this community has its money and this community doesn't, but they still get the project, how does that, I mean, this community might say, you know what, that's not fair. So what do we do in those instances?
Chair Wilson, what we do is, I mean, each project, once it's funded, once we've said go, follows its own path of steps. Some may be very simple. Some may have a very simple environmental document, no right-of-way to acquire, no complicated permits to achieve. And they're going to get to construction in a year or two. Another project may have great complexity, and it's going to drag and drag and drag. And that's just the system that we're in. That's the rules that we have to follow. We deal with law after law after law on project delivery. We have to make sure our right-of-way is certified. We can have a single parcel on a much bigger project be held up, be tied up with heirs and heirs to heirs, and we have to track down people. You know, I've seen parcels that have taken 25, 30 people that we had to get signatures from to get one sliver of property, and all of that held up the entire project. So I'm not sure there is fairness in this. We just have to follow these rules and be dedicated to the end result, which, as the commissioner said, is building projects. But not all projects proceed at the same pace once they're approved. That's just a simple fact of life.
Representative Gruenberg, and then somebody else over here had a question. Did you have a question?
I'll have a real quick question after you go. Okay. I defer to her.
Okay. Yes. I had a couple of lines of questioning, actually. First one is there anything we can do to simplify the process? So we don't need 25, all we need is 24.
Representative Gruenberg, to the chair, excellent question. I wish I could say we ask every year or every time the bill comes up for streamlining, for simplification. We don't get that. We get more complexity. The regulations that came to us in 2007 from the federal government are incredibly difficult to live with. They've added time, they've added really process, and process often means expense and staff time. I'm going to show you a few more things that have happened to us here recently that
without
show you that.
Without getting into the details here now.
Follow-up, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like you, and maybe with this committee, with the chair's permission, maybe to see what we can do either at the state level or through our contacts with other states and the federal delegation, using your suggestions to see what we can do to get this thing simplified if possible. That's number one. Number two, you were touching, this is entirely different, if I may. You were touching on the financing. And I'm wondering whether we should be looking at bonding any of these things, additional bonding, removing some of the state strictures in the Constitution that prohibit bonding in many circumstances, looking at Garvey bonding, and that sort of thing. Do you want to make any comments now?
The one comment I would make through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, is that the bonding, which essentially means it's state money, it's not federal money.
Well, Garvey is.
Well, Garvey is federal money because it gets repaid with federal dollars.
Through the chair, I'd like you to touch on both. I'm really focusing to some extent on that.
The one point I wanted to make was when we use state dollars, many of these rules go away. And the best example of that recently is the new interchange at Bagaw in Anchorage. That project took less than 3 years from the day you funded it to the day we cut the ribbon and opened traffic. We'd still be in the NEPA process if that had been federally funded. We'd still be years from construction. So there is the advantage of state funds to make projects go faster. We talk about it, but there's living proof.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Menard?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. It was just an observation I had on this particular slide. It said December 2005, and I was wondering if those percentages would still be, because that's 3 years old, I didn't know if that has changed quite a bit as far as the percentages.
No, those percentages are still quite accurate. There may be a couple miles difference on the size of the systems, but it would be far less than a 1% change.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
I apologize again. I just can't get my head around the notion of the restriction that you talk about. Maybe we can talk about it after the committee so we don't take up too much time, but it sounds to me like you've got six people sitting in a room scoring projects, and there's a little bit of wiggle room, and I think that's a lot of the frustration that you get from the legislature and from my constituents, that they are just not sure how, depending on who's in that room making decisions, some projects get funded and some projects don't. So I don't want to take up any more time, but I wanted to make that point. Maybe you can explain it to me in detail, get through my thick skull, I guess.
Let me show you a slide that's coming up that'll help explain something.
Thank you.
That's the slide right here. So how are projects selected? The primary way that a project gets into the STIP is that it's on an approved state-level transportation plan. This is written in both federal and state law. This is the method we're prescribed to follow. First, we do a plan, and then we write a more detailed spending plan to execute that project. So that's the dominant pathway. That's how most NHS projects, AHS projects get in. We use our state-developed, state-prepared spending, our transportation plans. We also use the management systems that are prescribed in federal law. And a management system is essentially a tool that's developed. We collect a lot of data about pieces of the system, like bridges or like safety conditions, and then we rank and sift needs using the data in those systems. They're very well developed. They are prescribed in federal law, and some of the safety systems apply to both state and federal roads, for example, safety, or the bridge ranking system. You heard today about bridge inspections. Well, it's the inspections that then get turned into numbers, which get turned into a bridge ranking system that tell us which bridges to go either correct or replace. We have the same kind of system for pavement. The pavement management system focuses only on state roads. It's not prescribed that we look at local roads. Those are the two dominant ways. Those are the two that are set out in federal law. So go back to the 1991 change. We had this 1991 change that suddenly opened up our universe of projects to everything in the state, unlike every other state in the union. So how do we get those projects selected? We're not doing plans for local government. We don't do plans for locally owned roads. We don't always have them in our management systems. So we had a gap. We had a gap in the system that said, we have a universe of potential eligible projects now, but no way to identify what's most important. We came up with the scoring system. And I think if you look at that scoring system, it's been evaluated nationally. There was a report that came out last year that gave us gold star for that scoring system, said that we had one of the best scoring systems in the country. I'm personally convinced that our problem is not that we don't want to build roads, not that we aren't picking good projects. It's just that when the list is this long and we can only do a little tiny bit of it every year, there's going to be a lot of upset people who'd feel like their project should be a little bit higher in the list. But no matter what we did, no matter who we moved to the top, there would be the 98% of that list that doesn't get funded that year. And that's a system that's never going to satisfy people effectively.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff, how does a proposal like the Road to Nome fit into this matrix?
Well, the Road to Nome is a planning document that is identifying, you know, the potential costs and benefits of that corridor. So if that were to come out with recommendations that begin to, say, proceed, we would decide to probably put that into one of those circles that is not scored because of the state-level road, state-owned project. Would end up in a plan, and then we'd have to figure out how to fund it. We'd have to figure out how much money it costs. Do we have the money to fund it?
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the way you're seeing this now, the Road to Nome, the state would not seek through the STIP process or any other way federal funding for that project. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, we would certainly consider federal funds, but you know, that's a few years off in the future. We'd have to look at how many federal funds we're receiving, what the other needs are, and make a judgment whether or not that's the right course. That will be an expensive project. There's no doubt about it. That's going to, if you just do the back of the envelope type math, you'll end up with a very, very large project there.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the problem with the Road to Nome in the terms of what we're talking about now at the STIP is it'll eat up all the federal money for some unknown amount of time, depending on what the final amount is.
Maybe I can answer your question with an example from the past. In Southwest Alaska, we did a plan. We identified the need for essentially what is a spine road that would start on the western shore of Cook Inlet, go across the top end of Lake Iliamna, and then go down through several communities and starting to link the Alaska Peninsula. And then we said, what's affordable? What's really doable? And what we ended up identifying was three smaller pieces of that much longer 250-mile corridor, maybe in no more than about 20 or 25 miles in total. And the plan ultimately identified those three smaller pieces as the priority today and said it looks to us like the rest of it will have to be done in another plan in another generation.
Okay.
So there has to be some reality check. Remember, the STIP is fiscally constrained.
Thank you.
The plans can be rose-colored glasses, quite frankly.
Senator Pascavan.
Yes, when it comes to the scoring system, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that as always there are many more needs than there are these federal dollars to apply to that. But the question that I have is whether it is reactionary in the sense that there are incidents that arise out of roadway characteristics, and if you have a number of those incidents arising out of roadway characteristics, then that puts it at the top of the list, and the exclusion of those that have fewer roadway incidents? Is that the scoring system?
Well, accidents, if you mean by incidents, you mean by accidents. Accident history would certainly be one, but there's about a dozen criteria. So accidents by itself will not dominate the scoring.
Unless
economic development.
Are they weighted as far as the characteristics? In other words, you said if there's a fatality or
right. That
type of thing, so then that's where the discretion comes in, as classifying something as a death or high level injury, and that's where your discretion comes in.
Well, we have a safety system that's doing that already, looking at every accident, and basically they get coded by the law enforcement officer on the scene, as whether there was a death, whether there was a major injury, and there's a definition for that. Minor injury or property damage only. So our staff aren't making those calls. They're just receiving that data. They store it and they keep track of it, and we can go back into the data systems and pull that out for any road segment in the state. And we can show you where the hot spots are. And we've already got a safety system, a highway safety improvement system, which is remarkably effective at finding those hot spots and making corrective actions. So we actually have a dedicated pot of money on safety, and we fund those specifically from that pot of money. And so I'll give you an example. You heard today that our fatality rate is down. And last year we had a fatality number of 63 in the state. That's down from a decade-long average of 85. And 2 years this decade, we hit 100. So it's the lowest rate of fatalities in, quite frankly, state history. We make it remarkable progress. Safety quarters is a big part of that, the safety system I just described to you. So I feel real good about our safety record and how we're achieving better safety results.
Can you, at the maybe a later meeting that we have, can you bring the criteria that you go by so that we can see it? Sometimes communities will say, you know, do all the communities know what the criteria are, or is that just something that you have, it's interoffice type thing?
They're published, they're on the web, they're out for public comment right now.
Okay. If you could bring that to one of the next meetings, that would be great so that we have it to look at.
Yeah, if I could say one more thing about the criteria, and I think this is a really important thing to understand. We have a group of staff called area planners. Every one of the regions has three or more of these area planners. Each area planner has a geographic area that they outreach and talk to communities they're in kind of daily or weekly contact with. And they really are the point of contact. They'll go out to a city council meeting and explain how to do it. They'll help them fill out the form. So they're not really left in the dark. There's people to call. There's resources to call from. I had a chance to be at a national meeting, and I happened to be sitting to a county official from Missouri. And he was from a pretty large county, about 40,000 people. And he told me he had not had someone from DOT at his county council meeting in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And when I got done describing our area planner system, he said, I want you to talk to that Missouri DOT. So I think we have a pretty good system. I know there's frustration, but I go back to what the frustration is. It's the amount of money that we don't have to address these needs.
Right.
That's the core issue here. Yeah. It's not whether we have a system that works or whether we've precisely got the right project on the list, because we want to do them all.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
Yeah, just, Jeff, you were around during the Murkowski administration in DOT, and it seems like the Road to Nome was part of that Road to Resources deal, and I don't know if that was just a label, or are there any special things that help get those projects? Because I think I remember the Governor Palin talking about continuing that program. Is there anything that helps projects under Roads to Resources?
The Road to Nome, you know, the big road, the road that would lead from the highway system west to Nome, was never in the Resource Roads program. It was a much smaller piece, the Rock Creek project, just a couple of miles of road right there on the outskirts of Nome. There were some big projects up on the North Slope that would have served the oil and gas development needs of the state. There have been many other smaller projects built, several in Ketchikan, one here in Juneau, several others in Mat-Su Valley. We actually have criteria out for the Resource Road Program, and this is a new thing. We didn't have criteria for the Resource Road Program during the Murkowski era. We published criteria for the Resource Roads Program. It, too, is out for public comment right now. And our problem there is we've only got about less than $8 million right now left. So, you know, you're not going to do a great many projects with that much money.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative.
Does that designation as a road to resource, does that make things easier to get those things done?
Well, road to resources money is state money, so if a project gets funded with it, it can go pretty quickly. We've done, we've done several projects in concert with DNR where they're opening up logging areas, and those projects have moved very, very effectively. They've gotten some things done.
Okay.
So if I may, I'll go keep.
But one more. Representative Mules.
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to the STIP, as I understand it, you're currently undergoing an update of the STIP and requesting nominations.
Correct.
What is the deadline for receipt of those nominations? And secondly, do you automatically fold in projects from your current STIP into the updated STIP, or do they need to be renominated?
A couple questions there. The deadline was just a few days from now. We just today have decided to extend it by a month.
Okay.
So we'll be putting out a public notice that extends it till the first week of March. I think it's on 5th?
Yeah, March 2nd.
March 2nd.
March 2nd, okay.
So that's news that's hot off the press. Any project that has already initiated, that is, we have started design, we have started the NEPA process, is essentially grandfathered in the STIP, because that once we do that, we're making an investment of those federal dollars, and as you'll see in a minute, we're on the hook to pay those dollars back if we don't continue that project. So We're not going to rescore something that's already begun. We're only going to score projects that have not yet got the nod.
Okay, and we don't have too much more time, so if I would like you to be able to get through your presentation, so we'll try to.
Let me try here. I'm just gonna. Okay, I'll be fairly quick. We have MPOs in Alaska. MPOs is a federal term, stands for Metropolitan Planning Organization. In our state, the AMATs and FMATs are the two MPOs. They are essentially partners in this program. They become the decision authority over both their long-range transportation plan and the use of federal highway funds in their geographic boundary. So they actually have dominion over that decision, even on state roads within Anchorage or state roads within Fairbanks. So AMATs and FMATs get an allocation of funds, and they are really the authority for transportation planning and transportation funds allocation within those two geographic areas. So let me just talk a couple things about this federal funds challenge, and I think this goes to Representative Groenberg's comments about could it be simpler. We deal with many, many rules. Just one example, there are 120 funding types in the federal program. Plus, some funding types come with an age class, so every year you have another class of funds and you have to keep track of it separately from its the year before and the year after. Most of these funds have a use or lose rule that we must get the funds spent on some project or that money goes away. So sometimes we do this switch around. People get very frustrated because their project hasn't moved. But if their project is stalled for whatever reason, we have to find a different project to put those dollars to, or they're going to go to another state. So the proper decision for DOT is to ensure these dollars don't leave the state, even if we have to slow down a project for some challenge that we're not responsible for. Further, many of these funding types and their time limits will drive the project choices we make. We had this happen last year, where we had a great deal of safety money and a great deal of bridge money that had to be spent on safety or bridges. And so the projects that went forward were, of course, safety projects and bridge projects. Since 2005, the new rules we're coping with have mushroomed. There's been quite an acceleration of the dynamics of the rules changing. And what it means for us is you heard the commissioner talk about retention, training of staff. Well, our staff become experts in this program, and then if they retire out or if they move out, and I've had both of those things happen here recently, where people leave the state for one reason or another, we have lost a very, very valuable asset, because it takes about 3 years to come up to speed on how to handle all this, how to deal with these fund classes. So I talked about rules. There's been ever more earmarks coming to the state. Well, earmarks are essentially a short circuit of all this planning stuff. It's basically Congress is just preordained, this money goes to this project, never mind the planning, never mind all the other steps. The legislature really is given no choice in the matter, nor is the state executive branch. It's just a preordained decision. But those funds are complicated. Many of the earmarked projects are not fully funded, so we're left with the conundrum. Do we take more STIP funds to flesh out the earmark project, leaving even less for projects that have been scored? Or do we tell the community that got the earmark, find the rest of the money yourself? No matter how you make that decision, somebody finds fault with it. There's just no way around that. Another thing that's happened is we've got a new pattern of rescissions. This is where Congress is taking money away in the middle of the year, and I'll show you that. We have a new rule that the age class of money, how to explain this? Say we have a project that's been going on for many years. We finally conclude it, and we have a little bit of money left over. Say that money is from the year, just for example, from the year 2000. We have to find a project from that era to put the money to. We can't put it to a project from 2009. We have to find an old project that's still active to spend it on, or we lose it. So this is a fairly recent rule. Another example of sort of the silliness of all this. And then finally, the time tap rule is being strictly enforced. New guidance in June of last year, Fed Highways wants all projects that have been started with federal funds to be completed, or the state is obligated to pay the federal funds back.
To be completed, define that a little bit.
To be completed sort of in due course. Now, if you've had environmental problems like genoaxis, they don't hold you accountable as long as you're showing that you intend to complete it. But if you've just stopped the project for your own internal reasons and don't have an external cause, and their policy actually says lack of funding, change of political direction, or lack of staff, all three don't count as valid reasons. So, wow. Just another one of the...
Very quickly.
Representative Johansson.
Are you required to expend all the money for the project? Say you had a project that you spent 50% and came up with a plan that only caused you to spend half the money. Say you had $220 million for a bridge in Ketchikan and you come up with an alternative that spends $100 million. What happens to the other 120? Do you have to pay that
well,
back?
Well, if you, in that example, if we're redoing the environmental document, and if the preferred alternative were, say, $100 or $100 million single-span bridge, just for example, and that served the purpose and need of that project, then that would be sufficient. We would have met the intent of the federal law.
Interesting.
So it's about achieving a transportation solution. So just a couple more slides here. This is our change in our funding targets as we began to understand what Safety Lou left for us. The two top lines there are the amount of money allocated to our two biggest programs, the National Highway System and the Community Transportation Program. And you can see there that our funding targets took a dramatic dive in the middle part of this decade. And that's a result of Safety Lou numbers and earmarks, rescissions, and set-asides. It's just less dollars available to projects going to the ground. I talked about rescissions. This is the amount of money that's been rescinded by Congress going back to 2005. It started out as a trickle in 2004, and it's rushing to a torrent. Almost $55 million this year will be rescinded. These are dollars we have to give back. So,
question?
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way we can get out of giving it back by diverting it to some of these other pre-existing projects or anything?
This is actually written in federal statute. It's going to be hard to change it.
So we have no choice?
We have no choice, as near as I can tell. There is a move right now for Congress to rescind the rescission. So.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Are any states investigating whether there are any avenues, whether litigation would be successful in this area?
I'm not aware of that, but I'll show you why the rescission was there. It was done as a way 5 years ago to balance the books, to write a bill that had a big promise without raising taxes to actually pay for those promises. So they basically said, we'll postpone the paying for 5 years and let the Congress in that time period cope with it. Well, 5 years has passed, so we're now coping.
One follow-up.
You know what? We want to finish
sorry.
This, so you know. I'm sorry, but
no,
we really
right.
need to continue, and you can ask him after.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm gonna just show you this one slide. This is an example of the projects that have been funded this decade under that 1991 law that opened up funding to other road classes in Alaska. You can see we've done an awful lot of. There's about 80 projects on this list. These are projects that have been completed this decade, largely in rural Alaska, many of them in the villages. And many of the village projects serve a very, very important need. They serve sanitation roads needs. So it's been a good thing that we've had this, but it's also subtracted from dollars available for big projects. So I just want to show you that when people say we haven't been doing anything, we have been getting around to business. That's about 8 or 9 projects a year going out into the villages, looking back in time. So federal funds is our big problem right now. My crystal ball says that the 2009 year we're fully funded for the year, plus we have a possible stimulus package coming our way. So it looks like a good, healthy year. 2010, there's a predicted deficit in the Highway Trust Fund, plus Congress has to pass a new highway bill to actually authorize those fundings, because the highway bill known as Safety Lou expires in 8 months. So Our concern with the new highway bill is, one, will there be changes in formulas? Will there be, you know, some new way the money gets allocated and Alaska doesn't garner $6 for every dollar that we kick in? Right now, we're the net big winners. I don't need to tell you what's going on in Washington and why that we're worried about that. But secondly, there's a lot of policy changes being talked about. There's just a tremendous amount of talk about greenhouse gases, global warming, and transportation is going to be asked to make amends for that. So transportation policy will be used as a way to drive greenhouse gas policy. What that means for us, we really don't know, but there's a lot to worry about. A couple more slides here. This shows you what's gone on with the Highway Trust Fund. This is a 50-year picture of the fund from 57 to 2007. It shows that the balance of the fund for about 30 years has been $10 billion or more. So they've been running a net positive balance in dollars in the Highway Trust Fund. During the dot-com boom, it jumped up to $20 billion, and then it fell off this decade. Now, I'm going to give you another chart that shows you just 1 year, 2008. So now we're going to just get one little slice of this chart going into the next year. This covers 12 months of the 2008 federal year. The forecasted balance is in yellow. The actual balance is in red. We started out with a net balance of $8 billion at the beginning of 2008, and the Highway Trust Fund became insolvent late in the federal fiscal year 2008. It actually went right to zero. But what happened? People stopped driving. They drive less, they buy less gas, there's less fuel taxes going to the Highway Trust Fund. So in just 6 months, that Highway Trust Fund went from a pretty healthy balance to zero. Go ahead.
Did other states suspend their state tax like we did?
No.
Okay.
Not aware of that. Congress stepped in late 2008 and provided an $8 billion infusion of general funds into that trust fund. They kind of reinvigorated it. First time in 50 years they put general funds into the trust fund. It's always been supported by user fees. It was essentially the first drop of the bailout money, because it happened about 2 weeks before the banking crisis hit, and they started talking about trillions of dollars. So this $8 billion was actually pretty controversial, but within 2 weeks it was just it was small change. So this is a prediction going forward for the 2009 year. The Highway Trust Fund at the end of 2009 will be at the zero balance again, which means we will start out the 2010 year with nothing extra in the kitty, no extra money. So it's a very, very big worry. To fix this problem, they will have to raise taxes or bail it out again. There really is no choice. And that's going to be our challenge going into the next year, is what will they do to solve the problem? Will they have gotten bailout itis by then? So a couple things to tell you about the STIP calendar. The STIP we're operating under right now, the 2006 to 2009, will expire here in about 8 months. There may be one more amendment to it yet this year. That amendment will largely be driven by stimulus once we have stimulus facts in our hand. The 2010 to 2013 STIP must be prepared by the start of the federal year, which is just 8 months away and October 1. So we've got a call for nominations out. We're updating the criteria. We will score those projects. We will program them in a draft STIP, ask for public comment, and have that ready by the end of summer. Oh, I've already talked about fiscal constraints, so I'll skip this slide. And to sum up, the STIP rules are more complex and demanding than ever. The federal funds are declining and growing less flexible because of some of the rules that are being applied. We share as a DOT more of our STIP than any other DOT shares among the 50 states. We have a federal program change coming in 2010, which could lead to big changes in policy. And despite these challenges, we must get that STIP amendment on the street right now. Otherwise, we will have no chance of spending those dollars. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate that the department came forward and kind of went over things with us and also shared the challenges that you have. So we really appreciate it. And for everyone, I just want you to know that next, in 2 days, on Thursday, we will have an update on the Alaska Highway System and also on the new proposed Alaska Class Ferry. So that will be good information for us to hear about also. So stay tuned. And we are adjourned at 3 o'clock.